68 this morning in Kenosha, 63 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On several different occasions, we've had the interesting opportunity of connecting with Professor Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, most often to talk about something very, very near and dear to his heart, namely the Shakespeare Prison Project. As many of you know, Professor Shaler, over the course of a number of years, has gone behind prison bars to talk about Shakespeare and other theatrical matters and to help head up a number of different compelling productions of Shakespeare plays with inmates performing various roles within those plays. With extraordinary effect on their lives and on the lives of those who've been able to experience that as audience members, for the most part, loved ones of the inmates. And it's also a program that's had a few, in a sense, logistical bumps along the way, but we're happy to hear that the Shakespeare Prison Project is alive and well. And as a matter of fact, this weekend there is a special benefit event happening at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, the public screening of an absolutely wonderful documentary film called Still Dreaming, which chronicles the true story of an assisted living facility in New Jersey in which a number of different people who in one way or another have been involved in the world of theater and or entertainment mount a production of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And the cameras of the filmmakers Jill Ann Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson are on hand to capture all kinds of memorable moments as actors and the two guest directors contend with this enormous challenge. It's really quite an extraordinary film, and again, being screened for the public this Saturday at 2 p.m. First of all, right here in the studio is Dr. Jonathan Shaler. We welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
And we have, via the telephone, the two filmmakers, although we're going to be having to speak to each of them separately, Jill Ann Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson, who also happen to be husband and wife, I believe. Is that right? Great. So good to have you joining us as well. Professor Shaler, a quick word about your own personal encounter with this film and why you thought it would be a really good choice to share with the public in this way.
Sure. I ran across this film a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, when it was still in production and they were doing some fundraising. I think it was via Kickstarter. And when I saw that this film was in production, I was immediately captivated for two reasons. One is the thought of A Midsummer Night's Dream being produced in a nursing home was absolutely fascinating to me, given that I work with Shakespeare in an unusual setting. And also, I knew very well about the filmmakers because of their incredible film Shakespeare Behind Bars, which was released in 2005, which in fact chronicles a Shakespeare project in prison, Shakespeare Behind Bars in Kentucky, Kurt Toflin's program.
Hmm. So there are some intriguing connections and parallels to what you experience with your various projects. So this is a great thing for us to be talking about. And I had the opportunity to see the film myself, and it is a very, very special film indeed. Jalen, let's begin by just getting a little bit of background on the kind of films which you and your husband have been making over the years. Professor Shaler mentioned another, which is very directly tied to Shakespeare. Are most of the films you make in one way or another related to the world of theater? And if so, why? Why is that such a focus of your efforts?
Well, the last two feature films we've made have been revolving around Shakespeare in an unusual setting, you know, first in the Kentucky prison and here at the Lillian Booth Actors Home. And I think, you know, sort of the deep reason is that this combination of Shakespeare in a place you wouldn't expect is so rich. And we kind of just didn't get enough of it the first time around, you know, with the inmates at Luther Luckett. They did The Tempest, and which is all about forgiveness. So that film really had its own theme of forgiveness, and it explored that idea. And, you know, Shakespeare's canon is quite large, and there's so many different human themes to plug into. And we were curious, you know, what would happen if we go to a place where we're working with, you know, aging. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if we'll do another one. I think this one has been a completely different film, and in some ways we were afraid, uh-oh, are we just making the same film again? But this one turned out to be really different in many ways. And, you know, I think it's just very fertile ground. And also Hank is an actor, so that's a world he really understands and is interested in. So I think for him it's a real personal reason, and for me I'm just sort of curious, you know, about it.
Tell our listeners about where this film takes place, namely the Lillian Booth Actors Home. Tell us more about this facility.
Sure. It's the Lillian Booth Actors Home is 10 miles from New York City. It's just across the George Washington Bridge into New Jersey. And it's filled with people who have lived their lives in the entertainment industry. Some of them were performers. Some of them were behind the scenes. You know, they could be a set carpenter or even an entertainment lawyer, or they can just be in a family that has entertainment ties. So in one instance, we have this great character, this person named Mary DePaula, and really has this wonderful comedic presence in the film. And although you think she must have been on stage as a comedian her whole life, in actuality she was a housewife and a mother, and it was her son who had a connection in entertainment, and that's why she's in the home. So it's a really remarkable place. It's a place where the staff really recognize their residents for who they are and what they bring in with them. And they really try to encourage that identity to remain with them. So that was one reason they really wanted to put on a full Shakespeare play, is they knew it would resonate with the residents, but also they knew it would be a big challenge for them.
At what point did you find out about this project? That is, the staff, in a sense, I mean, the way it's characterized in the film is the staff challenges some of the residents to mount this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Did you know about this project ahead of it being mounted? At what point did you become involved?
Yeah, we did, actually. We've been going to the home. We've been in talks with them for several years. I think 2009 we started getting really serious about maybe shooting something there. And they had a Shakespeare club at that time, but they were really interested in sort of upping the ante and doing something bigger with the residents and seeing if it could be done. They had never done anything this complicated or, you know, full-time. I mean, it was really full-time rehearsal for 6 weeks, and they were wondering, you know, can our residents handle that, and will they like it, and what will they get out of it? So we were not sure what play they would do, but we were interested in filming that process. And as it got closer, they chose A Midsummer Night's Dream. And because it's an ensemble and it has a lot of humor, and we thought that we would sort of take off on that theme of young love in the play, but what happened was something completely different. So,
tell us about brokering whatever agreement was reached in terms of you bringing your film cameras into that Lillian Booth actor's home and capturing as much as you did. Was that a delicate or difficult process, and whose permission, in a sense, did you have to secure in order to do what you did?
Well, the Lillian Booth Actors Home is run by an organization, a nonprofit called the Actors Fund, which was formed, I think, over 100 years ago, and supports actors in many different ways and people in entertainment in many different ways. And so we had to get their permission and obviously the permission of the home. And everybody was very gracious and very generous and excited. And so that always makes things a lot easier for us. You know, we have to have really an open door, because the way we make our films is we really go deep and we really try to get the candid real life as it's happening. So we have a sense before we go in what that access is going to be like, and if we don't feel, you know, like it's going to be pretty wide access, we turn in another direction. So we felt really good. We were really welcomed. It was one of the funnest films I've ever shot in terms of, you know, where we were going every day. Mm. And, you know, within the resident population, it was a self-selection process of who was going to be involved in this production. So it was open to anyone, regardless of capability or, you know, whatever was going on with them. Anyone could join into the group. A lot of people came the first day just to check it out. And what sort of happened was about 15 people ended up wanting to do it and understanding that the whole thing was going to be filmed. So, and then from there, you know, as filmmakers, we're kind of looking at everybody in that group as possible main characters of the film. But what happens is some people are more open than others, so we naturally gravitate towards them. So it's kind of a many-layered process in terms of access and emotional availability with different people, but that's basically how we approach it.
Right. I want to ask you a question, and then I'm going to ask Professor Shaler kind of a similar question with his own project. So when they chose A Midsummer Night's Dream, well, first of all, was that chosen by the administrators, or was that chosen by these two young men who are brought in as guest directors, Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody? And was that choice made with any idea that we can do this? I think we have somebody for this role and somebody for that role. And I mean, and it's an ambitious play on a lot of different levels. How much do you know about the choice of this particular play?
Well, the residents, you know, like Demo, who's one of our main characters, he's a very strong personality, and he wanted to do something like King Lear or, you know, a tragedy. And but, you know, the rest of the group was like, no, he's going to take it over, and we want to do something more fun. And, you know, Romeo and Juliet was thrown around, and they thought, no, that's too much death, and that doesn't sound like very much fun. It really was the choice of the residents. Ben and Noah were happy to do whatever they wanted to do, and Ben and Noah really didn't come in with an agenda, rather just showed up, how can we assist what they want to do, what this group of residents wants to do. So I thought that was a great approach on their end. And they didn't know, you know, as in the film, there's this great scene at the beginning where these two young whippersnappers come in from New York City to meet all these very experienced elders, and they get the third degree from these elders, you know, like, what are you going to do? How are you going to do this? Are you casting? Are you, you know, and it's just funny kind of scene where you think, oh, okay, this is not going to be easy for these two guys.
And maybe they hadn't known what they were getting in for fully.
They definitely had no idea what they were getting into, which is good for us as filmmakers.
Of course. Professor Shaler, I wonder how much that sort of part of this kind of resonated with you, this idea of undertaking a project and not being absolutely certain that you can or will be able to pull it off? And generally speaking, with your Shakespeare Prison Project, how are choices of repertoire generally made?
Well, great question. And I actually wrote down three questions that Jillian just asked a couple of minutes ago because I ask myself these questions every day. So thank you, Jillian. The first one was, will they like it? The second one was, can they handle it? And the third one was, what will they get out of it? I'm constantly asking myself those questions. We launched with King Lear because I knew the play very well, and I was ready to do it. And then after that, it's evolved. The process has evolved, and the prisoners have had more and more input. With our last choice, which happens to be, by the way, our most recent choice, A Midsummer Night's Dream. So this is very interesting. I originally contacted Jillian because I wanted to show it to the prisoners, and they've not yet seen Still Dreaming, but they will. We're going to be doing that next year, and the way we chose it was I threw out a whole bunch of titles, I think a short list of 12, and we debated and we surveyed, and they came up with A Midsummer Night's Dream.
And you were resolved to go with whatever their choice happened
yes.
to be.
Yes.
Whether it was a foolish choice or not, or foolhardy.
Well,
or,
I wouldn't call this foolhardy. But
no, not at all. But I mean, but it potentially could be. I mean, they might choose a play that might potentially be beyond the scope of a project.
Well, I felt like we had two layers of protection. One was it was Shakespeare, and that's a huge layer of protection in itself. You can't go wrong with Shakespeare. And the second thing was it was a short list of plays that I felt that I could handle as a director.
Mm. Very good.
I would love to see that production.
Well, I'll let you know the date, and we'll see if we can arrange that. That would be wonderful.
For those of you just joining us, we are speaking with, right at the moment, two different guests. Ultimately, they'll be our third. But we are talking, first of all, in studio with Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who also heads up the Shakespeare Prison Project. And this weekend, this Saturday at 2 o'clock, tomorrow at 2 o'clock, there is a public screening, which is a fundraiser, a wonderful documentary called Still Dreaming, which tells the absolutely true story of some residents in the Lillian Booth Actors Home and their mounting of a production of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Jillian, tell us a little more about Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody, the two young men who come in as the guest directors. I can tell from the T-shirts that they wear in the film that they are involved somehow in something that I think is called Fiasco Theater. Can you tell us more about their background and whether anything in their background or on their resumes had any sort of direct bearing on them being engaged for this particular project?
Right. So Ben and Noah founded a company with some other colleagues out of Brown University called Fiasco Theater. And we shot the film in 2011. And at that time, Fiasco was just sort of getting its legs under it. They'd had one very successful production of Cymbeline in New York City off Broadway that had gotten a great review in the New York Times. And you could kind of sense that they were the up-and-comers, you know. And what's happened since is, indeed, they've sort of been just skyrocketing in the theater world. They just had a really successful run of Into the Woods in New York City, and they've been asked to be in residence at the Folger Theater, which is a very prominent Shakespeare venue in D.C., and the Globe in San Diego. And so they've been doing a lot of stuff around the country, also the McCarter, I think, in Princeton. And so they're really hot right now. They keep getting extraordinary reviews, and it's fun to see them having such success. In terms of working with an aging population, they didn't have any experience at all. In fact, they usually work just with their ensemble and their company, and they'll cast just a few sort of outside people in each production. So they were very curious. They'd never themselves done Midsummer Night's Dream, so they were really interested in working with the play. And they were very interested in working with the older population from the entertainment industry. You know, I think they saw it like they thought they were going to get mentored and, you know, have this great, wonderful experience. And, you know, what happens is something that's much more akin to a roller coaster ride for them.
Yeah.
But we were interested from a cinematic standpoint in the fact that there were two of them and that they co-direct, because for us, then that means less talking head interviews, and what we can do is more observe their conversations and their reflections with each other and how they're trying to grapple with all the challenges that they're facing and that they weren't really expecting. And they're also very funny together, so there's a lot of humor in watching them try to navigate this whole thing. And that's one thing we really tried to do in the film, is make sure we caught all the humor that was going on. And so that's basically the story with Fiasco, and they're really great guys, really talented.
The timeline here is 6 weeks, and one of the really good choices you make is that there's kind of this time stamp at certain points in the film where we get a sense of where we are in week one, week two, week three, and of course the stakes really escalate as we get further into that process, and the performance date looms. Professor Shaler, how does that time frame compare with typically your preparations for one of your Shakespeare Prison Project productions?
We take about 8 to 9 months, and I know that Jelen and Hank are very familiar with that arc, because that's the same about the same amount of time that Shakespeare Behind Bars uses to prepare one of their productions.
So we're talking about really quite an audacious undertaking to, with this particular population, to be trying to mount as complicated a play like this in the period of 6 weeks.
Yeah, I would say so.
to say the least.
That's what we like to do. We like to up those stakes.
Right. So, of course, the heart and soul of the film is that we get to meet some of these extraordinary men and women who comprise the cast of this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And several strike us as particularly memorable, interesting figures. One of them, a woman by the name of Charlotte Fairchild. There are a couple of things that are important to know about her. One of them being, she herself characterizes herself as more of a song and dance person. So it's a good reminder that this isn't just a bunch of septuagenarians and octogenarians who used to do Shakespeare and are returning to their first love artistically. In some cases, we're talking about people who have never done this before in all their lives, even if they've been on stage doing other things. So, but there's more to Charlotte Fairchild than that. Tell our listeners about her.
Well, Charlotte is so captivating. You can see how she just would have lit up the stage at any age, and she still does. And she was in many original productions, Mame and Guys and Dolls and Fiorello and bunches of Broadway. She just did Broadway her whole life. And she's an incredible singer, and one of my favorite scenes in the whole film is Ben in particular is really struggling, and we find her at the piano with her accompanist, Joan Stein, and they sing this incredible Rodgers and Hammerstein song called You'll Never Walk Alone. And, oh, God, I just cry still every time she's hitting those high notes. But what's incredibly, especially poignant about Charlotte is that she has Alzheimer's, and usually don't find that out until later when you're watching the film. We introduce it later after you've really just grown to fall in love with her. And Demo reveals it that, you know, it's hard to believe, but she has Alzheimer's. And there are little signs along the way. But what's extraordinary is that how the play and the process, even though she's never done Shakespeare, she had a lot of drama experience, but how she can connect with the acting process and the Shakespeare language, even with her situation. It's extraordinary.
Explain what we see by the time we get to the performance in terms of Charlotte and another person who appears to be performing, in a sense, in tandem with her.
I think you're talking about the scene where Demo is rehearsing Oberon with her, and she's singing along with him?
No, I was thinking of, no. Maybe I'm thinking of someone
that
else.
Scene
I was thinking,
me.
Right? No, I
that's
I agree.
Earlier. Okay.
Right? No, I was thinking of where she appears to be kind of led around by. Is it a staff person?
So she has a personal aide who's with her all the time. And what was great is the guys gave that aide a part of the fairy. And so her name is Maylene Adams, and she was so thrilled to be a part of the whole thing because she loves singing and dancing herself. Mm. So she saw this as a wonderful opportunity to get tutored by a professional in song and dance and to be a part of this production. So, you know, she's there the whole way, and that's a pretty extraordinary relationship that they have, and it gives you a real insight into what we can do and how we can be with our elders, you know, even in these times when they may not seem like they're fully themselves. Or, you know, I always thought Maylene as just the ultimate example of how to be a caregiver and how to support that person that you're working for and with. And that's a really extraordinary part of the movie that we didn't delve into as much as we would have liked to, but I think it's there when you, you know, you're watching.
Absolutely. Another aspect of Charlotte, the fact that she has Alzheimer's, is that, as so often is the case, we have someone who is very much, in a sense, losing their connection to their own past and has probably kind of only a nebulous grasp of the future. But they're, in a sense, there in the moment, which can, in some ways, be a positive thing. But when it comes to, for instance, the arc of building a character and learning a role and understanding where a production is leading, probably her capacity was a bit limited, and we get a sense that that was a challenge for the directors as well.
Yeah, but I think they were delighted how she showed up. They always talked about how she was so present, and that was a real lesson for them, that, you know, they'd never really experienced that kind of intense presence before in the moment, and they really felt they would take that away with them.
Wow. Mm. Professor Shaler, I suppose for all the different people you've worked with in various productions, you've probably not ever faced exactly that challenge. I'm just guessing.
No, but you know, there's so many interesting resonances with this film and my work with the inmates, and I'm wondering if Jalen and Hank had noticed resonances. I'll just mention one for me, which was Lynette Luce, who plays Hermia early on, is talking about being in love and having her choice not approved by her father, and how it was difficult for her to say anything about that, and she ended up marrying somebody that maybe was not the best choice or the right choice for her. So she's thinking about the themes in the film, and how this, it seemed to me that this role, Hermia is a very strong role, a woman who speaks very powerfully about her desires in opposition to those that are scripted for her. And what an opportunity for her to play that role and to find a voice. I remember in King Lear, we had an inmate playing Cordelia who resonated so powerfully with that standing up to a parent and voicing one's own thoughts and desires separate from one's parent, and how important that was to him.
Mm. Speaking of Lynette, she's another of these residents who appears in A Midsummer Night's Dream. She also, although she's not contending with something quite as significant as Alzheimer's, she has her own sort of fragility, both mental and emotional, and we see that more and more, particularly as the performance date looms. I should think for you and your husband as the filmmakers, it must have been so interesting to be capturing those kind of moments of intense vulnerability, and I'm just guessing that there is a little part of you that was grateful for those kind of moments, and yet at the same time really feeling badly for this particular particular woman who found herself at certain points really struggling, and we wonder if she's even going to make it to the end. Is she even going to make it to performance date? Could you talk a moment about that?
Sure. You know, we really get close to everyone, and it's always hard to see them struggling. And you're right, there's always the two sides of the coin, where as a filmmaker, we see and sense that drama is building, and we're always grateful for that. And then we, you know, on a personal level, are really there with that person as well. And all we can do is sort of honestly observe, you know, and be there with our hearts and our souls. And in that way, I think people feel safe, you know, to experience whatever they're going through. And Lynette was incredible in that she starts in this very this very shy place at the beginning, you know, and you kind of even wonder, why is she here? And by the end of the film, she has found her own personal voice in a way that I don't think she ever had in her lifetime before that. And her children have seen the film, and her son in particular he's like, thank you so much for showing me this side of my mother and for having this, you know, in her life. And that was really incredible to hear that from him. And
wonderful.
Yeah, so it's, you know, and Lynette wasn't even on the radar as a main character in the beginning because she was, you know, so kind of quiet. But when we filmed in the gazebo, that scene where she reveals that, oh my God, she, like the character Hermia, had this real life experience, our main character antenna went up and went, okay, we are really going to follow Lynette. That was extraordinary. And then, you know, the way she finds her voice in the end is quite gripping.
Absolutely.
We won't give it away.
Sure. I especially appreciate one moment when she's talking about one of the exchanges she has with a character, and she confesses that I always feel like I'm about to cry. And is it okay for me to cry? She's asking her own director that. And of course, she probably, and maybe all her life, has never exactly experienced that before.
Right. Yep.
Another really memorable character is a woman by the name of Aideen O'Kelly. And she is someone else contending with something, a very, very difficult reality in her life. Say a word about Aideen the arc that she travels through the course of this production.
Sure. Well, Aideen is someone who's lived for acting, lived for Broadway, lived for the theater, worked with Samuel Beckett, worked with James Earl Jones and Christopher Plummer in Othello on Broadway.
Wow.
Very distinguished career. And she had to give it up because she's basically lost her eyesight, so she can't read. And she was also a liability on stage, not being able to see where, you know, the stage might fall off. So she had to give it up. So she, I would say, along with Demo, is the most excited to see that this is happening in the home. And she really takes it seriously. And she says, you know, theater is my whole life inside, and nothing has replaced it. And I just can't wait to do this, you know. So she comes with lots of energy and high hopes, and devises a way to learn the lines, and brings a lot of spark to the process and a lot of questioning of the young whippersnappers, you know. And, you know, ultimately she really struggles. So it's interesting to watch her journey, but I think it's, you know, it means a lot to her to be participating.
Right. There's also another woman in the film by the name of Gloria Albee. And what is her role in the production?
She plays Helena.
Helena, that's right.
To begin with, yeah.
Right.
And she was a playwright, and she never really acted. And she turns out to be a fabulous Helena. She's very tall and very fiery. And, and she has a completely different journey. She has what we find out to be dementia, and she seems very with it most days, and then she has some bad days, and you know, that provides some interesting drama.
Yeah.
Is she by any chance related to Edward Albee?
No, she's not.
Oh. It seems, I wondered the same thing.
Yeah, it would seem a natural connection, but I don't think so. Okay.
She is someone who kind of, in a sense, winks in and out of the production, and we see in the film some really dramatic moments when, for instance, she is forthrightly walking out of the home. She's taking herself out of there, and by doing so also taking herself out of this production, although she doesn't seem to even understand the ramifications of that she's leaving this production in its wake, in a sense, without a Helena. And the directors sort of lament the fact that the staff is used to that kind of in and out of with things that are going on, but of course they are not as directors. Professor Shaler, I wondered if you resonated with that, because in your Shakespeare Prison Project, I'm sure there have been at least a few instances where people wink in and out of your productions, not because they're checking themselves out of the prison, but
things happen. When an inmate is transferred, generally very little notice is given for security reasons. So we had a case in King Lear where 24-hour notice was given to our actor playing. I'm not even recalling the specific role, but one of our main actors, and we had to rally the troops and make a lot of phone calls, and were able to hold that off, actually. But in this case, I noticed that co-director Noah Brody stepped in as Helena, and I've had to do that. Step in, play a role that was, vacated suddenly.
Right. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know, Professor Shaler, you wanted to ask about what that was like for Noah Brody, who, mm-hmm. on the surface looks like he played linebacker on his high school football team. I mean, he is a, kind of a big brawny guy. And but he finds himself having to step in and play the role of Helena. And your film doesn't make a whole lot of that, which is probably wise. That's not the primary story here, but it's an intriguing wrinkle. Did you observe anything interesting about that as he finds himself suddenly needing to take on the role of Helena?
Well, when it first appears that Gloria probably won't be able to perform as Helena, they are wondering what they're going to do. They're thinking, are we going to find someone at the home? Are we going to bring in one of our friends from Fiasco? And ultimately, I think they realized that it had to be one of them. It was too large of a role to give to someone else, and they didn't want to bring in someone from the outside when they'd already formed that group, because this was, I think, like week five of 6 weeks. So it was really the only option, and there was a lot of fun jousting about, will Noah wear a dress, and he was dead set against it, and everyone wanted him to, and that didn't end up in the movie. But I think they are just really well versed in Shakespeare. For him it was kind of fun, and what happened was he got to play opposite Lynette, who is Hermia, and that really helped her come fully into that role, I think, to feel that real solidity of Noah playing that role, and that she could really be playful with him. That was a great outcome of that situation.
We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but we should also mention that the most important male figure in this cast is this very charismatic figure by the name of Demo Kandos, and he's obviously exceptionally gifted, exceptionally experienced, but he is also really hard to handle through the course of this production. And I suppose you don't want us to give too much away of this, but Professor Shaler, I suspect that in the course of your Shakespeare project in prison, you've maybe had figures a little bit like that, or not.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of anger in a prison. It's a very, charged setting, and given where people have come from and how things are in an institution like that, there's anger to spare. So, and under the pressure of a 8 to 9 month production process, things are going to happen. So, absolutely, we've had to deal with that.
So, you could identify with some of what these young directors went through. Mm-hmm. Jelan, what did you and your husband think about as you were crafting this film in terms of serving up a figure like Demo, so charismatic, but at sometimes also someone who really causes a lot of strife in the course of this production. Was it a challenge in terms of deciding what to include, in a sense, how he should be portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, I think we go through this long process with each character and trying to find the balance of where is it that they're telling the story of something that's important to say in the film, and where is it just becoming too much on that character. And Demo was so fascinating that in a lot of our rough cuts, there was so much of him. And people would be like, you know, I love that character, but it was a little too much. And, you know, so it's constantly, we were constantly trying to pull ourselves back and give everybody else an sort of equal weight, you know. So that's really happened in the editing process, and that's the art of, you know, balancing all those characters and all those plot points and the themes that you really want to discuss. And, you know, the themes for us in this film that really resonated were dreaming versus reality and perception and each person having their own reality because of their different abilities of perception.
Yes.
He's an unforgettable element in the film, that's for sure. Well, Jill Ann Spitzmiller, I think if your husband, Hank Rogerson, is still on hand, we will maybe pose just a couple of questions to him as we finish up. Is he still available?
He's here, and we share everything, so I will share the phone with him. And thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about
it. It's been great to speak with you.
And, bye, Jill Ann.
And as we let Hank take the line, let's just remind our listeners that we're talking about a public screening happening at the University of Wisconsin Parkside tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. A screening of this wonderful documentary called Still Dreaming, about residents at the Lillian Booth Actors Home mounting their own production of A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare, which is going to be one of the future projects of Jonathan Shaler's Shakespeare Prison Project. Hank Rogerson, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Good to have you with us as well. I wish we could have talked to the two of you simultaneously, but thank you for your patience. One question I had for you that I'd not asked your wife is, just say a quick word, if you will, about how the two of you work together as, for instance, co-directors and co-producers of this film. Just a brief word about the process and how the two of you work together.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's great to participate in this, and I'm really excited for the showing. She and I often joke that we're co-directors, co-producers, co-editors, and co-dependents. But I can't imagine doing this on my own after working with Jill Ann for the last 20 plus years, because it's very much of a back and forth, two-way street sharing process, where from the development of the project into production and then into post, we both really respect each other's creativity, so that, you know, all ideas are on the table, and the support is always there. For instance, in the editing, usually we do multi-character films, and so after discussing story and processing what the different characters are together, we'll go off and I'll take a few characters and she'll take a few characters and edit those characters from beginning to end, and then come back and share that, and then possibly switch characters. You know, like, I feel like I've done what I can with this character. Why don't you take them on and I'll take that character that you're feeling complete with. And so it's very much of a back-and-forth partnership and, like I said, one of respect and support.
One of the most intriguing aspects of this documentary is the mounting sense of tension as the projected performance date looms, and it becomes less and less likely that this performance is going to occur, or that it's going to occur in anything remotely resembling the way in which it was originally conceived. I mean, can they put this on? Can they pull this off? Is this going to all fall apart? What in the world is going to happen with this? I mean, and we get the sense that that's nothing that you artificially created with judicious editing the way reality television will regularly sort of ratchet up the tension, you know. And I mean, that sense of will this happen seems to have been a very real, authentic question. I wonder for you and your wife as the filmmakers, how much did you have a sense of, oh my gosh, is this going to go completely off the rails? And what happens to our documentary then?
Oh, absolutely. On a daily and weekly basis. I mean, you know, we'd go and film, and then we'd have to go home at night and process what the day was and where characters were going. And then possibly we'd have Sunday off, and we'd do more of that, of outlining story and outlining character. But definitely around week three, it was a six-week process. It was petrifying. It was really scary, that thinking to ourselves, oh my God, but where is this going to end up? Do we have a story? Do we have a film? even beyond the fact that if it doesn't even happen, what is happening here? Which kind of went along with the themes of Midsommar and with the themes of the film itself. I mean, we really trust that process that we go through as filmmakers. To try to bring out that authenticity. We don't, you know, the reality TV that you're talking about is fabricated.
Yes.
There's the term for documentary filmmakers, cinema verite, which is, you know, true cinema, true what's actually happening. Mm. And as artists and filmmakers, we really put ourselves on that journey, in that process, and then try to bring that out in the film, in the editing room, as much as we can.
Well, it's one of the things that makes this film especially powerful. In about a minute or so, Professor Shaler, did that reality of this story resonate very powerfully with you, that sense of will this happen, won't this happen, is this going to completely fall apart? I mean, I suspect you've experienced that at least a time or two during the Shakespeare Prison Project.
Yes, and as with this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream and Still Dreaming, it seems that as we get closer to production, people's neuroses really kind of explode. And it's kind of a fascinating thing to observe, but also I think it's important, I just say from my own experience, as a character-building exercise. I mean, if you can complete the project, if you can get through that space, then something important has happened to you.
And you're ready for anything. Yeah, I love the moment when one of these young directors are talking late in the process, and they're basically saying to each other, this story is incomprehensible. I mean, that is the story of A Midsummer Night's Dream as it is at the moment. No one is going to understand a single thing about it. I mean, they wonder if their own performers even understand what this story is. And so we are on the edge of our seats wondering what in the world will happen. Well, we will not say what happens. We will allow people to come to this public screening of Still Dreaming and experience it for themselves. Professor Shaler, remind our listeners of when and where and why this screening is occurring tomorrow.
Sure. This is Saturday, August 8th at 2 p.m. at the University of Wisconsin Parkside Cinema. It is Still Dreaming, produced by Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson, and it is just an incredible film, a beautiful, moving film that I think everybody should see. And we're doing this as a fundraiser for the Shakespeare Prison Project. It's very affordably priced, $7 at the door or online. You can purchase your tickets, and we hope to see you there.
Again, the film is Still Dreaming. Dr. Jonathan Shaler, great to have you here. And via telephone, the co-directors, co-producers of this film, Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson. Hank, you're still on the line, I think, and I thank you so much. And please pass on my thanks to your wife, Jillian, for your participation in this conversation.
I certainly will. Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. I'm Gregory Berg. On Monday's morning show, we talk with British historian Frank McLynn about his newest book, which examines the life of history's greatest and perhaps most brutal conqueror, Genghis Khan. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Today is going to be a partly cloudy day with a 50% chance of rain showers this afternoon, a high of 79 degrees, a 50% chance of rain tonight with a low of 65 degrees, cloudy tomorrow, a bit of fog in the morning, a high of 79 degrees, cloudy on Sunday with a 40% chance of rain, again a high of 79 degrees.